We are recording the audio, and the audio, along with the contents of the chat window and the deck from tonight, will go up on the website later on this evening. And we have quite a lot of material this week, and so let me kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Okay, so we'll get going with a follow-up from an item from last week. If you remember, Glenn was asking about, he had problems connecting to the weather network over Chrome, and there were various suggestions, mainly trying different browsers. I actually never had Chrome installed, so I thought I would try it. So I installed Chrome and instantly was able to connect with the weather network. So I tried turning off cookies, and I tried turning on security, and I tried it. All the checkboxes I could find that might stop the weather network from loading, but it always loaded. So whatever, Glenn, you did, I don't know how you stopped the weather network being displayed, but clearly one option is just to, I would suggest, is uninstall Chrome and reinstall it. It looks like a fresh install of Chrome will actually, is not blocking the weather network. So that certainly should be an option for you.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. Mm-hmm. If you're using some sort of ad blocker or anti-tracker software, that might prevent the weather network and several other sites from loading through Chrome. Because what happened on the sites I visit regularly through Chrome, and to get to them, I have to turn off my VPN, turn off the ad blockers, and turn off the anti-trackers, and then I can get to them. So that might be part of the problem.
Yeah, it's probably worth going through all your add-ins, turn them all off, and then see if the problem goes away. And if the problem goes away, you could bring half of them back and narrow it down, try and figure out which one is actually doing the blocking. A lot of people have dozens of add-ins installed in their browser, so that's certainly a good testing thing to try out.
I seem to remember Glenn said that there was a message to some effect that something was being blocked, or something was blocking his access, but he didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
And so you're right, Chris, that's a problem. If you got all kinds of add-ins been loaded from goodness knows where, and all you need is one that's blocking things, and it's tough.
Yeah.
And certainly it isn't Chrome, because Micheline just posted in the chat that she checks the weather network every day with Chrome. So it certainly isn't Chrome. Native Chrome isn't the culprit. Anyway. Okay, moving along then. We have another follow-up, and this time it's from Bob Walker. So, Bob, over to you.
Okay, let me just share the screen here. And okay, you see the window there properly?
Yep.
Okay, so a little while ago I did a series of presentations on privacy on the internet. And I have three updates here for some of that information. One is virtual learning apps track and share your kids' data. And a lot of kids, if they have to work, study at home or go to school at home through virtual learning, have to use the apps that the school prescribes. And a report from Human Rights Watch shows that millions of students who participated in virtual learning during COVID-19 pandemic, they had their personal data and online behaviors tracked by these educational apps and websites without their consent. There was no like opt-in, opt-out. It was just hidden in the background. And in many cases, this personal data was shared with third-party advertising technology companies. Of the 164 products reviewed across 49 countries, so this is a worldwide thing. It's not just Canada or the States or Europe. Out of 49 countries, they found that 146 or 89% of these apps appear to engage in digital data practices that, in quotes, risked or infringed on children's rights. And some of these practices included monitoring or having the ability to monitor children without the student's or the parent's consent and collecting a range of personal data that, according to the report, such as their identity, their location, their online activity, their behaviors, and information about their family and friends. The children, parents, and teachers were largely kept in the dark, but even if they had known what was going on, they had no choice. The children were required to either use these products and pay for it with their privacy or be marked as absent and drop out of school during COVID-19. The majority of the apps and websites examined by Human Rights Watch sent information about children to Google and Facebook, and those two sites alone collectively dominate the digital advertising market, and as well they sent them to several other ad technology companies. So most of the online learning platforms installed tracking technologies that not only tracked the students when they were using the apps, it trailed the children outside of their virtual classrooms and across the internet over time. So the kids were invisibly tagged and fingerprinted in ways that were impossible to avoid or get rid of. And even if the children, their parents, or the teachers had been aware and had the desire and digital literacy to do so, there's no way they could get out of this. And one of the worst offenders is CBC Kids, endorsed and promoted by schools and the government. And, of course, CBC is sort of an online, arm's-length part of the government in Canada in that they receive quite a lot of funding every year from the government. Children's Rights Watch found that CBC Kids had 29 third-party trackers collecting and sending data about the children to 18 different ad tech companies, including Google and Facebook. So the kids are back in school now, so what's the problem? Well, there's three issues. Some of these apps are being used in the classroom as well as for distance learning. The digital fingerprinting these apps enabled during the worst of COVID there, continue to track the kids' online activity now that they're back in school. And if there's any uptick in COVID due to a new variant, an unexpected increase in cases come the fall, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, this could lead to a return to distance education for a while. So if you have kids in school, you might want to think about this. Here are the URLs for some of the stories and that brought this to light. Another issue is that mental health apps are listening, especially because of the extra stress in people during COVID. A lot of people rely on mental health apps and trust them with their most sensitive and personal information. And so Mozilla Foundation, publishes Firefox and Thunderbird, among other things, found out that 32 mental health apps reviewed by them, 26 of them received their privacy not included warning label, indicating strong concerns over how they manage people's most private and personal information. And if you want more information on this, there's the URL there. And another one that was quite surprising is the Tim Hortons app on your smartphone collects vast amounts of sensitive data about you. It actually violates Canadian privacy law. And considering the fact that Canadian privacy law is pretty weenie at the best of times, that says something. and it included collecting vast amounts of location information from their customers. People that had the Tim Hortons app had their movements tracked and recorded every few minutes, even when the app was not open on their phones. The investigation came after the National Post reporter, James McLeod, obtained data showing that Tim Hortons' app on his phone had tracked his location to more than 2,700 times during less than 5 months. The app used location data to infer where users lived, where they worked, whether or not they were traveling. It generated an event every time users entered or left a Tim Hortons competitor, as well as entering a Tim Hortons. And whether they entered and left a sports venue or their house or their workplace. The geolocation data is incredibly sensitive because it gives a very detailed and revealing picture of our lives. The surveillance of our everyday movement reveals where people live, where they work, as well as information about visits to doctors and medical clinics, places of worship. It can be used to make deductions about sexual preferences, social and political affiliations, and much more. So once they got caught with their hands in the cookie jar, I guess the donut jar, Tim Hortons has agreed to implement recommendations that the company delete any remaining location data and direct third-party service providers that they provided this data to do the same. They've agreed to establish and maintain a privacy management program for their new apps, and they've agreed to report on measures that they've taken to comply with these recommendations. So for more information, there's a URL there. So that's it for today.
Thanks, Bob. I just wanted to remind people that the contents or the links that we have in the deck, I do paste them into the chat window if you want to pick them up there, or you can pick them up from either the deck or the contents of the chat that get posted onto the website later on.
Did somebody have a question there or comment? I thought somebody was trying to get in when Chris started talking. Okay, well, I don't see anything in the chat, so thank you very much, Bob, and we'll move on to the next, which is a smartphone basics question. How do I make an audio recording? Well, it turns out there's kind of two options, but it depends on what phone you have. Lots of phones have a built-in app, so you can certainly use that if you have one. The alternative is to go with a third-party app. Typically, you download that from the Play Store. And I checked out one of them, and this one seems to get good reviews. It's called Easy Voice Recorder, and there's a link there to the Play Store and also a how-to video. Not that you should need a how-to video, because it's a pretty simple app. I think it only has like two control buttons, maybe. So you run the app and you get this screenshot, which basically says that it's ready to start. And of course it's lying to you, because as with a lot of apps, before you can do anything, you try to start it up and it needs permissions to do things. And one of the permissions it needs is to be able to use microphone, which is kind of reasonable considering it's an audio recorder. And the other thing it wants is a location on disk to be able to save the recordings. And again, well, I guess if you want to, no point in making a recording if you're not going to save it and listen to it. So I suppose both of those things seem quite reasonable. Anyway, once you get the permissions set up, you basically have to just worry about this big red button here. And when you press it, it will start recording and you can see the waveform as you're speaking. And there's a little check mark down there, which is basically how you save recordings, and you can save it as the default name, or I think you can change the name by clicking on it, right-clicking on it or something. Well, certainly you can change the name later on in a file manager. It does have a bunch of options. So if you go to this three dots menu up here and the three dots menu up here and the settings menu, you get things, a whole bunch of esoteric things like auto gain and cancelling echoes. And you also get to be able to change the sound quality setting and tuning, which is what kind of file format you want and what kind of parameters on the recording. And then once you're done, you hit the start or pause button here, save the file, and you're done. So it's pretty simple. Something in the chat here.
Yeah, we have a question. Can you record phone calls or just in person?
I have no idea. I never use it. I just tried it out, and I only tried the in-person thing. So I don't know whether you can do phone calls. You'd have to check that out.
And Tom pasted in the link to a Play Store app recorder that also transcribes your recording.
Ah, yes. Go Google, right? Yeah, that can be quite useful, too, I guess, where you get a printed version of the audio recording. Okay, moving along then. Stuart has a couple of items. Are you going to talk to these slides, Stuart? You were thinking up some text, I think.
What? What?
Go for it.
Right, I made a suggestion. What the heck was it? Okay, amalgamation of health tracking data. Wasn't that it? Sorry, I'm...
No. Oh, that's the next slide. This is the Android apps thing. The Android Authority.
Well, same shit. Different story. Yeah, okay. Android Authority is a website that purports to be an authority on Android. Go figure. As any other website does, it has all kinds of fascinating information. One thing that can be useful is every, oh dear, I think it's Saturday now.
That's what it says, Saturday.
Okay, because I'm not looking at, I don't see it on my screen, but I've got a whole bunch of new stuff going on my screen. I'll get into that in a moment. Every Saturday they have a thing of the best, newest and greatest apps that we must try out. And usually they're games because they target the younger generation who spend more money than us old farts on various things like that. This one was something about amalgamating all your data from various health tracking devices and services. And I thought it might be useful for all of us tawdry, old, decrepit people who are just, you know, barely getting by on our pins, who probably need a great deal of support, therefore require health tracking app data information. Anyway, they talk about it being incredibly secure. Oh, yeah, of course. I think they're chasing Apple being a secure ecosystem. Android is notoriously unsecure, as everyone knows. But if you're already invested in the Android ecosystem and you're using Android devices and software, well, you know, you've already made your choice, so what the hell? Health Connect may help you amalgamate your data into one useful platform. I don't have the money for any of these wearables and health tracking data things. I don't use any of them, but, you know, you folks may. Android Authority is fairly reputable, but they tend to push the newest and greatest, most interesting things, not the most reliable. You want to see how many people take the bait. So, you know, if you're into it and you're using health tracking data and apps, look at this app. Many people will start screaming about data security and information privacy. But like I said, if you're already into this, you've made your choice. That's all.
Okay. Thank you, Stuart. So I guess that's anybody who has a Fitbit. They must access the stuff like that.
How is this different from the Google, the usual Google stuff?
It's from Google.
Yeah, so it's the same as Google tracking?
It's an amalgamator.
What does it have extra? What does it bring in?
I said, ask Google.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Can you give me the address?
By the way, okay. Yes.
Onward.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Stuart. So moving along, we have a little item here, share. Actually, this is provided basically by my brother-in-law. He uses an app that provides all kinds of tools, and this thing is quite nice. It's a double tap. It works for Samsung phones. It may be Android-wide, I don't know, and it may be Android version-specific. But it's one of these things it's just like Microsoft and their display settings. They put display settings here, there, and everywhere. Well, Android does the same thing. It has display settings. It has advanced display settings. It has accessibility display settings. And so if you don't know what you're looking for, you'll never be able to find it. And this thing, on my phone, it's under settings and advanced features, not display. And then you go to motions and gestures, and you'll find this menu here. And you've got a double tap to turn on the screen and a double tap to turn off the screen. I don't see the point personally of turning off, because when I close my wallet, it shuts down anyway. But double tap to turn on is quite nice, because I used to use a program called Wave Up. And when I opened up my phone case, I could just swipe my hand over the light sensor and it would turn on the screen. But in Android 11, I think it is, WaveUp doesn't seem to work anymore. So this is kind of an alternative. By putting this setting on, I can basically open the case, double tap on the screen, and the screen turns on. So it saves all that wear and tear on the power button. And it's quite convenient if you like just to tap the screen rather than press a button on the side of the phone. Anyway, it's there for anybody who wants to try it, and if it's useful to you, good luck. Okay, moving along. Follow-up from Chris on phones and banking.
Yeah, so we had an email request come in from Diane Prock saying she wanted to send email money transfers from her iPhone, and she wanted to know if she needed special protection software in order to do it securely. And she noted that she did have a subscription to Norton VPN. Actually, she said Norton, I followed up. I assumed it was VPN. I followed up the question about whether it was Norton VPN or just the Norton Security Suite, or which I don't know if it includes VPN. So I didn't receive a reply to it. So I decided to go ahead with this anyways, with going on the aspect of a VPN. She noted that it slows things down, so she doesn't actually use Norton VPN on her desktop or her phone. Next. So we did talk about banking from a phone on the June 1st Q&A, and I include the link there, and I will paste it into the chat as soon as I'm done here. And the overall conclusions that we came to was that it would probably be most secure to use your phone for banking if, first of all, if you use your, you make sure your device is free of malware, in particular keystroke logging software and things like that. We talked about some of the options for doing that. Use the mobile network or a private Wi-Fi such as one at home rather than a public Wi-Fi. Probably more secure if you use the bank's mobile app if they have one, rather than a web browser, and using multi-factor authentication, which I'm not 100% convinced it really is going to help for this all that much, but it certainly doesn't hurt. But I think really the risks are quite low in terms of using your phone to do any sort of internet banking. Next. So as a follow-up to the that Q&A, the June 15th Q&A, Tom pointed to an article, The Best Privacy and Security Apps for Android, and the link is there, and I'll paste that in as well in the chat. One of the items in that list was to add in extra layers of encryption to use a VPN. And I started thinking about this a little bit, and I thought, well, how useful is a VPN to guard against one of the main things that was a caution in using, in particular, public Wi-Fi, and that's a man-in-the-middle attack. And I came to the conclusion that it actually is excellent mitigation for man-in-the-middle attacks, as was outlined in the June 1st Q&A. So I'd like to go through and recap what it is for a man-in-the-middle attack and how a VPN will actually address this. So if we look at this, we have your device, and it makes a connection accidentally to an evil attacker. The way that this ends up happening is that the evil attacker is in the same location as your Tim Hortons or whatever, where you're trying to connect to Tim Hortons VPN, and their signal happens to be a little bit stronger, so, and it's named the same, so your device ends up connecting to this evil attacker. So they are going to masquerade as both the legitimate Wi-Fi, and they're going to masquerade as your bank as well. So you start up, you do an encrypted session, of course, to your bank. And so the encrypted session actually goes to the attacker rather than your bank. The trouble with this is that it's not really very easy for you to see that your encrypted session is with something other than your bank. Next. So once you make that connection to the evil attacker, they start up a separate session with the bank. And what they will do is they decrypt the traffic that comes from your device. Then they'll re-encrypt it and send it on in an encrypted session to the bank. And so they will pass the traffic back and forth. So everything looks copacetic to you. But you don't realize that in the middle, this evil attacker is actually decrypting all your traffic and then passing it on to the bank in a different session completely. So they have plain text access to all your information, including your account and password, and then they can go in later on and they can remove money from your account, or maybe they'll put money in your account, who knows. So that's how it happens without the VPN. So with the VPN, it starts out the same way. You still end up connecting to that evil attacker. A VPN isn't going to protect you there. But then what happens after that, next, is that you make a call out to the VPN server. Before you even go to your bank, your VPN kicks in and it says, okay, I want to make a connection to the VPN server, which goes through the evil attacker. And so there's nothing you can do to really prevent that. But the next step is that you get an encrypted tunnel between you and the VPN server. and there is nothing the evil attacker can do to decrypt that traffic. It is a negotiation between you and that VPN server, and all that traffic going from to and from your computer is going to be going through that encrypted tunnel, whether it's to your bank, whether it's to YouTube or your mail server or whatever. So that, although the evil attacker is there, they can't see the traffic anymore. Now, what happens is the VPN server, they've had this encrypted session with you. They have to decrypt that traffic in order to connect on to your bank when you decide that, yes, you want to actually connect to your bank account. And so the VPN server makes that separate connection to the bank. However, there's no security problem really there, because the next step is your data is also encrypted separately between you and the bank. So you have the encrypted tunnel, and then through that tunnel, there's an encrypted session that is between you and the bank. So that's an end-to-end encryption that is going on. And so that's the way that the VPN will protect you from that evil attacker in the man-in-the-middle attack. There's one little wrinkle to it, is that you are transferring trust to your VPN provider. Because if you look at that diagram, you'll see that there is that break in the green overall session at the VPN server. So in a sense, they become man in the middle. Okay, they could act the same way as the evil attacker is actually doing. You are trusting that your VPN provider is not doing that. I think in most cases, VPN providers are probably worthy of the trust much more so than an evil attacker sitting in a Tim Hortons or something like that. But just realize that there's no such thing as 100% when it comes to security, and that VPN server, you are placing trust in that VPN provider that they are not acting in a malicious manner. But that's the way that the VPN will actually help you if you're going and using public Wi-Fi. And if you use a VPN, then in using public Wi-Fi. It's a virtual private network, and so it's virtual because it doesn't physically exist. It's private because it's encrypted, and it's a network because it is transferring information between devices. She says she can access it via a Norton subscription, but I didn't know how it differs from other security features. So, yeah, most people don't understand how VPNs work. And if you have any questions specific to, the diagram that I've got on the screen there now, by all means, pipe in, and we can try and clarify things.
I guess the really important thing about VPNs is the encryption, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what the P is, the private and virtual private network, is that it is encrypted information. And so the benefit that you gain from that is that nobody between you and the VPN server, the service provider, nobody can sniff the traffic anywhere and get anything usable information on that. But realize that the VPN server, that service provider, has to decrypt the information and pass. It on to whoever it is, or your mail provider or whatever, they have to decrypt that traffic. And at that point, the only thing that becomes usable in terms of privacy on your information is if you have an end-to-end encrypted session with whatever service is at the other end. Fortunately, most places nowadays, they are defaulting to encrypted sessions rather than unencrypted sessions. So that's when in your browser you have the little yellow lock. And if you click on it, it'll say, your connection is secure. It means you have a secure connection, encrypted session between you and whatever is at the other end. As I have said before, in terms of using HTTPS, you have an encrypted session. Do you know who you have an encrypted session with? And that can be the $64,000 question sometimes. And I've outlined a number of times on how you can examine the certificate when you do have in your browser an encrypted session, and you can decide whether the information is indicative enough of who it is that you're connected to, that you trust that other end.
And then, Chris, a number of people are saying that you're freezing on them. I thought it must be my internet wasn't downloading fast enough, but it's your Rogers Ignite is slowing down for some reason.
Yeah, it seems so. I did get a pop-up saying your internet connection is unstable, but yeah, nothing I can do about it. Sorry, folks.
So Diane's asking, if she downloads the bank app, does it have its own VPN?
Probably yes. One of the issues with banking apps is they're pretty opaque in terms of what they actually do, but they certainly have the ability to build into them means of getting around man-in-the-middle attacks. They certainly are going to have an encrypted session between you and the bank. I would suspect that they are more secure than using a web browser to access your bank. So I think you're probably better off with a bank's app. However, you're putting trust in the bank and how well they can code or an app for them, or who they can contract to code a secure app for them. It's a bit of a crapshoot in that you have to give trust in them, but the abilities or the capabilities of building in security into an app are better than the ability to do things over a web session.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. I think Diane sent in a second question, which was that she often see ads that say scan here for more info, but how do you do that? And in particular, how do you do it on an iPhone? And now that's a problem because iPhones are those Apple things, the dark side of computing. And we're an IBM PC user group. But we also have Android phones, which are essentially built on Linux. So we know a bit about scanning apps. So scanning apps are essentially for barcodes and QR codes. And barcodes are the things that you see all the time in the grocery store on just about every product. And the cashier runs the barcode over the scanner, and the laser beam scans this linear set of bars, which is the barcode. QR codes are actually two-dimensional, and so because of that, because they have more space, essentially, and more bits and pieces, they can hold a lot of information. Now, on a phone, typically, you get one app, which is a barcode scanner, and it will also do QR codes. And for most of us, QR codes generally will give you will link to a website, so you'll see all kinds of information on the browser. But they can contain other information, so you can have email addresses and postal addresses and text messaging and all that kind of good stuff. So the question is, how do you actually do it? Well, there's a couple of different scanners which I have used. I used to use one called Barcode Scanner. It's a fairly old program. It's open source, I think. Pretty simple and worked very well. But then I started, on Chris's recommendation, I started using Sophos antivirus suite called Intercept X these days, Intercept X for mobile. And it turns out that Intercept X has a scanner built into it. So if I need to look at a QR code or a barcode, I now use Sophos, so I don't need to have barcode scanner installed anymore. But the real question was, for iPhones, and so all you iPhone users out there, which app do you use? And I was at a gathering of some friends last night, and several of them used iPhones. I'm told that there is an app built into the Apple operating system that will scan both types of codes. But again, I've never had an iPhone, so I don't really know.
I can answer.
Is there anything on that, Chris?
Sorry?
Anything in the queue? In the
The only thing is from Tom, he says QR codes can hold up to 4K of information. The Google camera can scan QR codes, and he notes that QR codes can have nasty stuff in them. And certainly, you know, he said, for example, resetting your phone. And so, yeah, you should be careful about what you scan. And there have been examples of parking meters that had the ability to pay by scanning a QR code, and somebody pasted over a QR code that you ended up giving your money to somebody else other than the city. So, yeah, it's one of those trust things. They decide whether you trust them or not. Jocelyn notes there are many sizes of QR codes, so the amount of data depends on which one is used. And Gail popped in and said she can advise on the iPhone side of things. So, Gail.
Well, if you're scanning a document, was it just particularly QR codes or a document? Because if you're scanning a document on an iPhone, there's an app called iNotes, or Notes, and you go to it, you pretend you're going to create a document, so you hit the icon to create a document, just like in any app, and then there's a camera, and if you hit the camera, it actually gives you the option to take a photo or scan the document. So you don't need to use any other app, you just use Notes, and Notes is built into the iPhone.
The question was specific to QR codes. What do you do for QR codes?
Okay, I have an app. I have an app called QR Scanner.
Is that built into the operating system, or did you download it?
I downloaded it from the Apple Store. It's called, I guess it's, and I didn't have to pay for it. It was free. That's what I used for my COVID thing.
And what was the name of it again?
It's the same principle. I just exited. for the scanner, it's QR. Yeah, QR Scanner is the one I got.
Okay, thanks, Gail.
Okay, so next we have a share from Chris.
Yeah, I was on Thorat.com the other day and came across an interesting article. So first off, there are 4.3% of all Windows users are still on 8.1. The end of support is January 10th of next year, which is just 6 months away. After that, there's no promise of security fixes. I have promise of in parentheses because Microsoft has been known to put out security patches for non-supported operating systems, but they certainly don't feel any compulsion to do so. And starting real soon, Windows 8.1 users are going to see warnings popping up saying that their support is ending soon and you should upgrade or whatever. So I haven't seen any examples of what the warnings are actually going to be, but they are going to be along the lines of telling people that they're going to be out of support very soon. So an interesting thing to consider that is if you are on Windows 8.1 or you know somebody who's on Windows 8.1 who you like to help keep secure, there are a number of options. One free option is you can still upgrade to Windows 10 for free, and it will preserve your apps and data. And the end of support for Windows 10 is going to be October 14th of 2025, so that buys you a couple of years. The next free option is to upgrade to Windows 11 if your hardware supports it. I suspect that most people who are on Windows 8.1, their hardware is probably old enough that it's not going to be supported for Windows 11. But if it is, you could upgrade directly to – well, you can upgrade to Windows 11. Most of the data I've seen says that you can upgrade directly from Windows 8.1. To Windows 11, there was one indication I saw that said that you would have to go through Windows 10, but a number of sites have said that you can upgrade directly to Windows 11. It will preserve your apps and data. One site said that apps may need to be reinstalled, or some apps may be, need to be reinstalled. And the end of support for Windows 11 is unknown. Right now, Microsoft, I forget the term they use for it, there's two support periods that they have. I think it's modern support, which is what Windows 11 is on, or there is permanent support or something like that, where they've specified an end date for a particular piece of software. Modern support is basically saying that they will support it for 2 years. Now, the presumption is that they will continue to put out feature releases every year, and every feature release that they come out with will be supported for 2 years. So the feature releases will be free. They have not stated any point in time where they say that you will have to upgrade to Windows 12, because they, as far as they're talking now, they're just upgrading Windows 11 for the foreseeable future. At some point, they will probably pull a stunt like they did with Windows 10, which they also said was going to be the last version of Windows out there. And at some point, they will declare a new version of Windows, at which point you'll have 2 years from the release of the last feature release of Windows 11 before you'll have to upgrade to something else. So that's free as well. And next, you can switch to Linux. And I knew we would get a cheer from Alan on that one. So that's free, and most of the apps are free, but you are faced with new apps. So there's a learning curve. In most cases, I think that you could probably find feature equivalent, shall I say, apps that are available on Linux for virtually everything that you use on Windows. However, you may be faced with some apps that you currently use in Windows that you can't find an equivalent under Linux. So that's the one sort of bugaboo I see in moving to Linux. However, lots of people have done it very successfully. And as I say, pretty much all the apps as well as the operating system are free. And so you're not faced with this additional cost items at some point in the future.
And Chris, quite a number of Windows apps actually run on Linux using Wine.
That's true too, yes. Now,
but you're right, some don't.
Yeah, yeah, so, yeah, some. It's always going to be the case that there's going to be some stuff, but you can always run Linux as either a dual boot or a live CD or flash drive and try out the apps, make sure that you have everything that you need before you commit 100% to it. And if you do it as a dual boot, you never have to fully commit to it. You can gradually move over to it and only give up Windows when you decide that everything you need is actually available under your Linux installation. And next, you have a dollar cost item as to buy a new computer. If you have a Windows 8.1 computer, it's probably getting pretty old at this point in time. So you might be looking to upgrade anyways to a new hardware. And if you do, it will come almost certainly with Windows 11. You can still get some computers with Windows 10, but the vast majority of the hardware out there now has Windows 11 pre-installed on it. So that's certainly an option for you, is just to buy a new computer. And then lastly, you can accept the risk. I do not recommend accepting the risk. I don't recommend that anybody use an operating system that is unsupported from the vendor from a security point of view. However, I know a number of people that are still running Windows 8, Windows 7, and they have people on Windows 7 or prior, they've just decided to accept the risk at this point in time. That's your choice. But it certainly is an option, not one that I recommend.
So there's a question or a comment, I guess, from Natalie, that she can't upgrade one computer to Windows 10. Not quite sure.
From Windows 8.1? That's unusual. I mean, I'm not disputing it, but it is unusual that a Windows 8.1 can't run Windows 10. But if that's the case, then that certainly drops off the first two free options. Because if it won't run Windows 10, it definitely won't run Windows 11. So switching to Linux is one option. Buying a new computer, which would come with Windows 11 pre-installed. Or if you really like Windows 10, you can probably still find a new computer with Windows 10 on it. Or deciding to accept the risk. And the risk is unknown. I mean, as soon as Microsoft decides they are no longer putting out security patches, you can bet that the bad guys are looking for vulnerabilities that they can exploit on people who are running Windows 8.1 because they know that it's not going to be patched. And if you end up with it's a zero-day attack in that the vendor has not got a patch available for it. And if it's something that can be exploited directly across the Internet, you're sitting duck. Is it likely to happen? Probably not highly likely. But as we all know, security vulnerabilities come to light all the time on operating systems. And so if and when it happens, you could be sitting in a pretty untenable situation.
One option, and it depends what you're using Windows for, but the idea of dual booting with Linux is actually not such a bad option. And you can use Linux for just about everything, but if there are things in Windows that you really need, you could run Windows in dual boot and maybe just disconnect it from the internet. So if your app doesn't need web access,
true.
You could use Windows kind of as a standalone, not connected mode, and then I think that would be pretty safe.
Yeah.
And you can always download stuff on Linux and copy it over to the Windows machine if that's the kind of an option too.
Yeah. I mean, to my thinking, that would be acceptable risk to take at that point. That's definitely an option.
And Natalie's saying that it's hooked up to the TV to stream from the internet. Well, you can probably do that on Linux.
Yeah.
And there was a question here from Tim that he thought that is Windows only available for 64-bit? Windows 11, sorry.
Windows 11.
Is there a 32-bit version of it?
I don't know. Let me just do a quick check on that. I doubt it
because it's looking at those new CPUs, and I don't think there's any CPUs in the last few years that have been 32-bit.
Let's just see. Windows 11 32-bit support? No, not supported anymore. Windows 11 has compatibility layer for x86 programs that are still used today. You can't install Windows 11 on a 32-bit only PC. So that's the answer to that, I guess.
Okay, very good. I think we've covered all the questions that are in the chat window. I was trying to keep track of them and change the slides at the same time. But we have a few minutes, so basically if there are any other questions that people have, or questions on something we've already talked about, we have a few minutes that we can cover those. So you can either put something in the chat or unmute your microphone and ask away.
We just had a question from Natalie, actually. Does that mean programs that are only compatible with 32-bit won't work on Windows 11? No. Windows 11 does support 32-bit apps running on it. It's just Windows 11 itself won't run as a 32-bit. So yes, you can run 32-bit apps on Windows 11. And Diane says, I have an old computer with an unsupported version of Windows. It can't join my network because I've changed networks. Can I download the photos from it to a disk or something? Yes, certainly. I mean, if you're just looking to get the data off of it, You know, you could download them onto a flash drive or a CD or something like that to transfer them over. I'm not sure what is meant by it can't join my network because I've changed networks. You should still be able to, or is it just a case of you don't want to join it to the network due to the risks involved, I guess is the point. It should be still physically possible to do it. I don't recommend having it connected to essentially the network, the internet, but if you did it for a short period of time, just transfer data, but you could always do it by flash drive or CD or DVD as well.
So Edward is saying he believes that Windows won't run all 16-bit apps.
That's true.
You can actually do that running DOSBox.
Yeah, but there's 16-bit Windows apps, and that's true. Those are unsupported. Mm-hmm. I think support for that went away at Windows. It's a prior to Windows 11. That went away.
Mm-hmm.
64-bit Windows can run 32-bit apps. 32-bit Windows could run 16-bit apps. So the first version of Windows that is not available for 32-bit. Yeah, okay, so that means that Windows 10, if you ran 32-bit Windows under Windows 10, you could run 16-bit apps. If you run 64-bit Windows, you cannot run 16-bit apps. You can run 32-bit apps under it, but you can't run 16-bit apps.
So the fix there would be to run a virtual machine and load an old version of Windows.
That's true. Yeah.
And Tristan's pointing out if you want to transfer files, you could just pull out the hard drive and plug it into a newer computer. Natalie's asking, has a friend who used Kaspersky, and the workplace has banned anything Russian, good for them, needs to switch. Are there any recent antivirus reviews on the OPC website? Not on our website, but there's lots on the PC Magazine does quite a regular antivirus review, and I'm sure if you look on Google, you'll find all kinds of them. In my view, there's nothing wrong with Windows Defender.
Yeah, I just run Windows Defender. I run some other security software, but for antivirus, I just run Windows Defender, and it's getting pretty good reviews lately, up with all of the major ones out there. Realize that antivirus, there's no such thing as a perfect antivirus out there, and so, yeah, I just run whatever you want and keep it up to date. And Windows Defender is low overhead, relatively speaking. Keeps itself up to date as part of the Windows update process, and seems to do quite good job.
And just a point on the online reviews, quite often, especially the commercial websites, they'll push commercial, proprietary, paid-for software. So you might want to look for reviews of free antivirus suites, because they typically, again, tend to be perfectly fine. You don't need to buy it for an annual subscription on antivirus, in my view.
Not for the antivirus portion, certainly. The thing that the companies that give away free antivirus, and they have a commercial product as well, what they're hoping is that you'll install their antivirus, the free one. It'll find some things and you go, wow, this found stuff that my other antivirus didn't find. And then they will inundate you with, ads popping up saying that, well, you know, if you upgrade to our premium package, you will get these additional benefits. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. It's just that it's not part of the basic antivirus. The basic antivirus is what you absolutely need. The other capabilities, which might be parental controls, or it might be a VPN, or who knows what. So if you do go that route, and they start popping up with ads for their commercial product, take a look at it and see if there are things in that that you really want, or do you just want to stick with their free antivirus?
Okay. Well, if you look in the chat, you'll find there's a whole bunch of comments about operating systems and antivirus suites and all kinds of wonderful things. Anyway, we've hit the magic witching hour, so it's time to start wrapping up. And let me start by just reminding you that next Monday is the last in our series of OPCUG Tech Talks. And in fact, today is the last call because we won't have another Q&A before next Monday. So as you see on the screen, it's Chris is going to be talking about wireless security, how to lock down your router and basically easily protect it from all the bad guys out there. If you haven't already registered, just a note that you do have to register because we only send out the login credentials to people who have registered. So if you go to the website, you'll find the page there with all the information that you need. So we'll see some of you on Monday. Our next Q&A will be next Wednesday, July the 6th. We have some information in the pipe, but we're always looking for more. So if you have questions or things that you want to share, please let us know at the address on the screen there, and we'll be sure to reserve your spot. So lots of interesting topics tonight. Thanks to everyone who provided them, asked the questions, gave the input. That's it for me. I'll see you next week.
Thanks. That's it for me too.